Just a reminder, after the speaker is through, please remain seated until after the baskets are passed. Tonight, our main speaker is Milton M.
Good evening, my name is Milton Merle, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I think it's a privilege. I want to thank Chuck for asking me to share here tonight. I think it's a privilege to share in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but especially here, because it's a privilege to speak to one of the largest meetings ever held on a regular basis in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is absolute credit to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a privilege to be here. There's a lot of people here that I know that have seen me grow up here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know whether I got growed up yet or not, and it's unimportant. The thing I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I can stay sober one day at a time, and that my life, if I am willing to do follow the simple steps of this program, gets better and better. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1948, and I don't want to get into a long drunkalogue. I drank enough to get there in 1948 and didn't think I was an alcoholic, and there's no doubt in my mind that there are people here tonight that don't think they're alcoholics, not really are convinced they're an alcoholic. The only thing that convinced me that I was an alcoholic was alcohol. That's the only thing ever convinced me. Jails never convinced me. And I made 20 of them. Nut wards never convinced me. Alcohol is the only thing that drove me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think about Clint. And Clint's one of the few people I first heard around this program that summed up my feelings as a child. I come from one of those Pentecostal religions where they pray all the time, pray and spit on you. That's what they do. And I used to see them falling out in churches and speaking in tongues and walling around in the floors and doing all those things and just hollering and going on. And my mother would raise her hand and say, "Thank you, Jesus." And I want to know what you, I couldn't see him in the first place. And I couldn't understand the joy that they had. And I didn't have it. I knew something was wrong with me. And I say that because if you're new here tonight, and you see us walking around with that stupid, silly grin, you know how we do, just grinning. You don't know what the hell we're grinning about, just grinning, you know. And you see us walking around with a stupid grin, don't feel out of place. Because eventually, you'll walk around with this stupid grin too, like, and you won't know what's going on, just grinning, like you're one of them, you know. And I didn't have that. I didn't have that when I was a child. And they would have this feeling, I knew something was wrong with me. And I knew that someday that I was going to go to hell. I just knew that because I had a little sinful mind, you know. And I knew Jesus was watching me all the time. He never took his eyes off me at all, you know. Because the song in church would go, "There's no hiding place down here." And the song, the words of the song, "I went to the rock to hide my face, and the rock cried out, no hiding place." And so I knew that Jesus had a pair of binoculars watching me. Now, if you think about that, that is the height of ego, that Jesus didn't have any time for anybody else but me. You know. And I knew he was sitting up on a little cloud somewhere saying, "I'm going to get that little fellow one of these days." And I always knew that. You know, I knew that there was no thing like heaven. They talk about, well, I'm going to be in that place where there's no more pain and there's no more sorrow. There is joy untold forever. I knew I'd never have that because I was so bad. You know, I was a sinful kid. Looked up girls' dresses with mirrors and things like that. Jesus was watching me too, you know. And I knew that. And I had a lot of things going for me when I was a kid. There was no way, I don't think there was any way, I could have found or had a peaceful life with the kind of feelings and the thoughts I had. To make a long story short, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1948. I came from a very good home. My mother and my father, neither one were alcoholics. They loved Jesus. They were good people. They were loving people. They gave me everything any kid could have. Now, I didn't come from a destitute background, so I can't blame it on my background. Because in depression, when people were starving, I was eating. At Christmas time in 1929, don't try to guess my age. I know I look good. It's all right. If that's my ego, so be it. But my father brought my brother and me and Atwater Kent Radio. And some of you may know about Atwater Kent Radios. Now, they stood about as high as this podium here. And they cost $129. In 1929, my father bought his first piece of property in Newark, New Jersey. That's where I was born. So I can't blame it on being destitute or being hungry or being a starving kid. You know, it seems to me, and this is my opinion, I've been around here long enough to get one or two of them. It seems that we, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that as a result of something else in our lives, we're alcoholics. I don't adhere to that. I'm an alcoholic because I drank alcohol. I don't know of any other way to become one. I may have gone crazy without it, but I became an alcoholic because I drank alcohol. It had nothing to do with my mother and father. And the only way I can get drunk tonight is by drinking. I can't get drunk any other way. Now that I'm convinced of. It took me a long time to understand that around this program. But in 1948, I'll get back to, I got to AA. I'm not going to tell you about my family. They were good people. I had a brother that seemed to get along well in the family. He didn't seem to feel like I felt. He didn't seem to feel inadequate. He didn't seem to feel less than. I didn't think he felt the way I felt. In fact, I never asked him, so I really don't know. But he seemed to be able to function in that home. I had problems in my home all the time because I seemed to be the center of attraction. I always kept my mother's and father's attention. I tried it first by puking. Now, I was puking long before I drank. I'm a professional puker. I want you to know that. And I did everything to keep their attention. And I used to wonder why my brother was so angry at me. And I've come to know, when I look back in retrospect, that how he should have been angry at me because I kept their undivided attention. They had no time for him because I kept them occupied with me. Like I'd steal church money and lie about it. I would do all sorts of things than to hear I have my mother going to church saying, Lord, just pray for my son. I had them doing that. I didn't understand she was talking about her powerlessness over another human being. I couldn't understand that. I felt embarrassed that she would expose me like that in church and no one would tell me what was wrong. I got arrested in 1948 for the final time. And I had been arrested up to that point 20 times, and this time I got arrested. I had gotten married. I married one of those little church girls that I knew Jesus would get if she didn't love me. And it didn't work. It just didn't work. We had two children and I ran away from home a lot. I used to go chase girls. I was scared of girls, but I used to chase them all over the place, you know. I talked that man talk and walk that walk. And, you know, and all they had to do was tell me to shut up and sit down or slap me. I'd have cried. You know, that's the kind of guy I am. You know. Wimp from the word go. I'm a wimp, and it's wonderful to be a wimp when you know it. I don't have to deny that anymore because it's not about any of that stuff I thought it was about. Because I'm positive in this room tonight, there are many people that feel like I feel. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous works so well for a guy like me. Because when I came in, thought I was unique. I was really unique when I got here. I was so unique, I was black and didn't want to eat watermelon. Now that's how unique I was. Until a guy in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who was black said, I don't like to eat it either. And it took away my uniqueness. It gave me the one message that a guy like me has to know. And the language, I believe, of Alcoholics Anonymous amounts to two words. Me too. Me too. You can walk in here if you're new and say, well, I've been arrested 50 times. And there's somebody in here going to say, yeah, well, me too. I've heard him say, I've been married 4 or 5 or 10 times. And somebody says, well, that's all right, me too. The sameness. We're not you. We're not different. We want to be unique. I wanted to be unique so bad. Unique in sobriety. I wanted to be different in sobriety even. And slowly but surely you carved all the ground out from under me so I could stand alongside with you and be just like you. In 1948, I'm back here again. I was arrested out of a whorehouse trying to be a pimp. I drank the kind of alcohol that told me I could be a pimp. I was scared of girls, too. Now, if you're a sharp-minded alcoholic like I am, and I don't think I'm really that sharp-minded, I call it a genius-type mind. Because I have the kind of mind that makes puking make sense, you know. That's the kind, I make going to jails make sense because I kept doing it over and over and over again. I made sense selling blood time and time again. I did all those sort of things. But this time I got arrested out of the whorehouse because I took some money from a cousin of mine. He and I used to run the streets of Newark, New Jersey, getting drunk together, smoking grass, you know, snorting a little horse every now and then, you know, puking and snorting, you know, that kind of thing. That's the kind of lifestyle. And this time he came to this house, this whorehouse, and wanted me to pay a bill. And I had the shake so bad that morning, and I had that money, and I had to have a drink to think. I don't know whether people did that or any of you did that. I used to have to drink to think. Because when I'd come off a drunk, my head would be going around so bad, and it was like a neon sign lighting up. And I wanted to stop it so I could think. And if I could just get a drink in me, just one drink, I would kind of settle down. And I could figure out what my next move was going to be. Because somebody was going to pay for my drunk. I didn't know who it was, but somebody was going to pay for it. Yeah. And this particular morning, he gave me that money, and I needed a drink. And the lady who was the madam of the whorehouse, and this is what I was going with, she was 60-some-odd years old. And I wouldn't pick a young one, of course. And she taught me how to drink when I had the shakes so bad. I drank wine in those days out of a tin cup. And she would chill, it had this chill tin cup, and we poured a wine in, and I couldn't pick the cup up. And she said to me, I'll tell you what you do. You just take a towel, and you wrap your hand around the cup, and you throw a towel around your neck, and you pull it up, and you drink it down. And God, it worked. It worked. If you have the shakes, that's the way to get a drink down. Especially when the cup moves or when the glass moves. Just take a towel and wrap it around your hand and the glass, and pull the towel up. It'll go down. When I got that drink down, I went about my business with every intention to pay that bill. And when I got there and put my hand on the knob moved. And I knew I need to have another drink. And so I went to find me a drink, and this time I went and found a case of wine. And I found a bag of grass, and I found some heroin, and I took all my buddies and we had a party, and the next day he had me arrested. And I stood before the judge, and the judge said to me, son, what's wrong? And I didn't know I told the judge the truth. I always thought I was smarter than anybody else. I don't know whether any of you like that, but I thought I was sharp. I really thought I could outthink you, outwit you. That was what I had going for me. And this judge had asked me a silly question, I thought. But when you ask a guy like me who has a genius-type mind, a question like, why would another cousin arrest the other one? When you ask that kind of a silly question and you know the judge is going to put you in jail, you have to come up with the right answer. And the answer has to cover all the bases. You just can't give him a little simple answer. You've got to give him an answer that covers it all so he can't ask the next question. You got to answer the question. All of them he's got in his mind. And I told him this. The judge, your honor, I love everybody. Now, the reason I told him that, my mother was sitting there. Jesus had told her where I was. And I knew I had to keep her quiet because Jesus would make her tell everything, you know. And my mother was a source of embarrassment to me. I don't know about anybody else's mother. My mother always embarrassed me. Just always made me. She came to the whorehouse once. And can you imagine this devout church woman? Now, the whorehouse is right across the street from the church she attended, you know. And can you imagine this woman come to the whorehouse knocking on the door, you know. And the woman opened the door, and I said, "Mama, what are you doing here?" She was on my parade again, making me like a little boy, like her little boy. And I didn't want to be a little boy. I was on that path of trying to be a man. God, I wanted to be a man in the worst kind of way. Oh, if I could just be a man, I'd be all right, you know. And I was forever trying to prove my manliness. And where else can you be a man but in a whorehouse? You know, and here comes your mama knocking on the door. Yeah. I knew that Jesus told her I was there, and so I had to keep her quiet. And that's why I told the judge I loved everybody. That meant her, that meant him. And I added a little more to that. I said, "Judge, I even love my wife and my two children. But when I drink, everything goes wrong." And I didn't know I had told the man the truth. I had no idea I had told him the truth. Because every time I did drink, something went wrong. Every time I drank, I went to jail. Every time I drank, I wound up in a nut ward. Every time I drank, I ran away from home looking for some other woman to take care of me. Every time I drank, something went wrong. Every time I drank, I lost a job. Every time I drank, something always went wrong. And I didn't understand that. What I understood was that I wasn't doing it right. I hadn't had the right mixture or the right combination, and I didn't know how to do it. And I just wanted somebody to teach me how to do it. And he said to me, "I can put you in jail for a year, but what I'm going to do is send you to a man here on the fourth floor. It was the Hall of Records of Newark, New Jersey. And you see this man, his name is Frank. And if you stay with Frank any amount of time, I will hold you, put you on 9 months probation. And if you hang around with him, I won't even let this appear as a record." So I went to see Frank, and Frank sent me to see a guy named John. And I always share this at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I paid it absolutely no attention because, number one, I wasn't an alcoholic. John said to me, John was old. He was a very old man. And my mind said, when you get as old as he is, you need to quit doing whatever you're doing. And so, you know, what could he tell me, an old man like that? He needed to get ready to meet Jesus. Not me. He needed to get ready. And John said this to me. He said, "Milton, they don't make black and white whiskey to all get you drunk." Because John, I guess, may have thought that I might come up with the old adage that, you know, John, if you're black like me, white man's got his foot on your neck, you're not going to get anywhere in life. What is there left for you to do? But get some little menial handkerchief head job, pushing somebody's broom, saying, "Yes, sir, boss." You know, you get paid on Friday night. You go to the bar, you have a few drinks with the guys, then you go home and beat your wife. He knew I might say something like that. He said something else. He said, "Milton, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have to love you, or their resentment might get them drunk." That's heavy. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous have to love you, or the resentment might get them drunk. Now, I don't know about you. When the bed used to spin around and spin and spin and spin, and you stick your leg out there and you want that sucker to stop, and it doesn't stop. You say, "Oh, God, please send me somebody to love me just like I am." And he was saying to me, there's a whole room full of people that have to love you like you are. Not because they're wonderful. He simply said because they can't allow the resenting of you to get them drunk. So you got to love me. I like that. Newcomer, we have to love you. Or act like it. Because we can't allow the resenting of you to get us drunk. That's just that simple. And the man, my prayer had been answered. That prayer of, "Oh God, send me someone to love me just like me," it had been answered. And I didn't even know it had been answered. And he said something else. He said, "Milton, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic." And I said, "You know what I said." And I'd had to die some more. Now, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells you about a guy like me that drank horribly for years. And then this young man in the book decided he wouldn't drink anymore. And once he amassed his fortune, he would then retire and drink like a country gentleman. Well, it happened to me this kind of way. I got a break through a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who went into show business, and sang a while on WRTV back in New York. And when he told me he needed me, I quit him. And I quit him, and the simple reason I quit him was because I didn't think I was worthy of being there, because when you've been bad, you're going to hell anyway, and God's going to get you. I really sum up just that little, that small. And then I got another break. God gave me another big show, show of shows, big one, one of the biggest TV shows they had. And I was on that show, I was just singing. I knew I'd be all right now. I'd have the money, the cars, the women pop my fingers, and the women come running. It would just be wonderful, and I could get even with them. I could get even with Mama, Daddy, my brother. I could just show them, you know. Because they kept saying, why don't you be like your brother? And I tried to be like my brother, and I hated him for setting the standard so high. Yeah. And now I wanted to get in that place where I could have a pocket full of money. And my mother would walk up to me and say, son, I need a thou. And I wanted to lay that thou and say, uh-huh, you should have been on me instead of that dumb brother of mine. You see, that's how I felt. I never gave her $1,000 to the day she died. And I found out that's what she was, that was not what she wanted. All she ever wanted for me in life was not really to give my life to Jesus. That would have been wonderful. But what she wanted from me was just to be a sober son. That's all. And it took Alcoholics Anonymous to make me become aware of that. To make a long story short, I drank that one away, and I got with another group. Group called the Dominoes, Billy Ward and the Dominoes. I sang with them for many years and went with this group, and I said to them, I won't drink. I've been a bad drinker. I've been in jail. I didn't tell them all the crazy stuff I did. But I told them my problem was my wife. And if I could get a divorce from her, I'd be all right. So they told me they'd help me. And I started singing for them. And for 12 years, I didn't drink. It was the most miserable 12 years of my life. The most miserable. Because all of those feelings I had running around rampant in me, I couldn't put on my track shoes and run. I couldn't smoke a joint. I couldn't snort. I couldn't take a drink. I was just miserable. And the only high I had was when I performed somewhere. And I'd get so high. But when I'd come off that high, I'd go in a corner and sit down somewhere. There was nobody looking at me. Like, you know how lovers look at each other across a room? The guys would have their girls who'd come into the nightclubs, and you'd see the lovers, that lover's look that goes across from one to the other, you know, and God, nobody was doing it to me. I was so lonely. I was so, so lonely. I was so scared. I was scared. Playing those big, smart supper clubs in Vegas, I was petrified, you know. Then I made another big decision. What I needed to do was get married again. And I started to marry a hooker from Western Avenue that I didn't know, so I couldn't marry her. It would have been the first interracial marriage in Nevada. But God sent me my present wife. We're married today. A lot of you people know her. Her name is Ruby. We've been married 28 years, and that's a miracle. Yeah. God sent her to me. I believe that, because she walked into a door in Portland, Oregon, and a little voice said to me, at that time in my life, I said, I'd never, ever marry a woman again as long as I live. But somehow the God had some other plans in mind for me, and this little young thing walked in the door. And God, she just took me by storm. And a little voice said to me, Milton, that's the girl you marry. I know it was the voice of God. I don't have any questions about that in my mind. Because I understand what God has been trying to do all the time. When I had all these great opportunities, I just know today that all God was trying to do was get my attention. And he found out how to get my attention. He sent that little young, innocent thing in there. She was young and innocent and naive and didn't know anything. I knew I could teach her. You know, just, you know, bring her up the way she should be brought up, you know. I don't know about you guys. Guys, every man, I don't care who you are, every man would like to have a woman he can just bring up and kind of just cuddle him and just, you know, it's like my father used to say, just sit at the table, and God, that was a command. That meant stop. That's all. Never say a word, just, you know, and that's power, you know, and he had me trained to that, you know, and if you could just have that kind of power to have a woman that just, you're like, the least whim you had, she was there just waiting on your hand and foot. Every guy has that idea in his mind that she is going to be that little soft, docile thing, you know, That's what he has in mind. And God sent that to me just to get my attention. And she was wonderful. We got married after a year of courtship. Now, I couldn't marry a woman of my own race. I had tried that. I knew I couldn't fit the bill there. I knew that. Because they kept saying, I want a man. And I knew I was no man. So I knew I couldn't fit that bill. I couldn't marry a white girl because I'd been walking down Hollywood Boulevard with some of those statuesque, gorgeous things out of Vegas. And I was walking down Hollywood Boulevard one night and some guy hollered out the window, this gorgeous thing, said, hey, you nigger lover, you. And my mind said, she ain't worth dying over, Milton. You know. So I couldn't marry her. So God sent me Ruby. And Ruby's Chinese. Now that really made me different. I've always known I was different. I felt different. I knew I was different. And when I was at show, I kept my hair processed. Jenny's sitting there. Jenny knows I came to AA with my hair processed. I could take my hand, just throw it down and kick it back. You know. Because I didn't want you to think of me as some little kinky, naughty-haired kid that sat on a picket fence, a white picket fence, eating some watermelon. I didn't want that image, you know. And so, I wanted to be different. People would say to me when I'd perform, are you from the West Indies? I'd say, yes. My father's from the West Indies. I come from Barbados. I'd go right into the brogue. I know how to do that. Someone would ask me I was from India. I'd say, yes, I'm from India, Pakistan. You know, I knew how to do that. I wanted to be everything except a black man from America. Now, that's where I was. And God sent this little Oriental into my life. And that really made me different. Now, you know you got to be really, really special when you are walking and got this little cute little Oriental thing. You know the Orientals will say, God, he must be something different. And everybody around you has got to say, he's different. He's not run of the mill. And she presented such a great picture of Milton. It was so representative of Milton that he was so special. Because I wanted to be special. And God, it was wonderful. We got married, and she waited on me hand and foot. And God, it was just wonderful. We have a daughter. She's 27 now. She's working with Pepsi Cola. She's a graduate. And this was a girl we tried to abort. And God saw fit to bring her here anyway. We're very proud of her. But Ruby and Roseanne used to wait on me hand and foot. In fact, Ruby went to Akron Stores once. And got a bell for her and Roseanne. And said to me, Milt, when you come off the road, you're too tired. So when you want us, don't call us anymore. Just ring the bell. And I'd lay up in the bed, ting-ling-ling-ling-ling-ling. And Ruby'd come and they'd bring the food, you know. Oh, wait a minute. I know some of you think it's chauvinistic, don't you? It isn't. It's sick. You see, I'm a living example, and you don't hear it much in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard it when I first got here. There were a lot of little cliches that made sense to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And through the years, I've seen it change over and over. I've seen it reach its fruition, that sick attracts sick. Now, that's just how it is. I didn't make the rules up. And I know if you're like me and you've been sober and you do sober things and you're doing all those sober things, no doubt in my mind there's somebody sitting here tonight and saying in their eyes, I don't need this crap in my life. This woman talking about all this stuff of yesterday, I don't need this in my life. What I need to do is go find me a new one. Because these little cute things in Alcoholics Anonymous say, you know, the women's, something happens to women when they get to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's magnificent. They get color. Their hair gets gorgeous and shiny. Their eyes are shiny. And their little butts just wiggling. God, they look wonderful, you know. And they say nice things to you. They say you're wonderful. And they say you're cute. One told me I had a cute tush, man. And I love that, you know. I never knew I had one. They were just wonderful. And this at home is sitting there talking that crap. And you say, I don't need this. I'm sober. And you go hunting and start hunting around in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can assure you this. When you find one, she's going to be set. Because sick attracts sick. That's how it is. And I've watched it over and over and over again. I can run away from home tonight if I want to. But I'm positive the one I go to got to be sick to tolerate me. Because I'm no prize catch anyway. I don't want to stand here and tell you because as a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've become a wonderful, responsible human being. I don't like responsibilities, period. I don't go hunting for them either. I don't want to be responsible for me. That's just how it is. I like to be taken care of. That's why to me, and it may sound kind of left-handed or right-handed, whatever way, it may sound a little weird when I say to you, I really adhere to that third step in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That we become willing to turn our will and our lives over to the care of. And I translate that as to the care of the caretaker. Because I'm convinced tonight that God is my caretaker if I just let him. He has taken care of me through all kinds of adversities. He has taken me high, taken me low. He's been there. He's been the only constant thing in my life, drunk and sober. I recognize his presence even drunk. That he was there all the time because I was trying to kill me. And his wonderful hand held me just long enough to get me here. Just to do the simple things he asked me to do. Stay sober one day at a time. Live and let live. And the old sayings in Alcoholics Anonymous says, by the inch it's a cinch. And to let go and let God, because that's what I stayed sober on. I didn't stay sober as a result of reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed sober because they said, don't take a drink one day at a time and go to meetings. I couldn't read the book. When I read the book, I'd pass out and fall asleep. And all I could hang on to was the old slogans. And I was up on Los Feliz Boulevard just not too long ago, and the very first meeting I attended in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1967, and I was in that room. That room, it was a wonderful room. It was a small shoulder-to-shoulder room. And in that room in 1967 is when I heard the first thing that made sense to me. And a guy named Wendell met me at the steps and said, Milton, if you can buy the simple thing that all you ever thought in life, your schemes, your plans, brought you to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and they're totally invalid for you, they will not work for you. So if you can buy that simple idea, you're on your way. And he added one more. He said, Milton, quit listening to you. And I said, Wendell, who will I listen to? He said, everybody else except you. And I've been trying to do that ever since. And he told me to do what sober people do, and I've been doing what sober people do. I've read that book, and I keep reading that book. It's taken me years to find out when the book says what a spiritual awakening is. And it's not in the appendix, but it's in the book. And when I'd come up with my mouth, you know, when you get sober, if you're like I am, you want to impress everybody that you're into this thing, that you're talking this talk. And I didn't know what I was talking about, but I was talking the talk. People who met me thought I was years sober. There's one guy walking around here, 20 years sober, and said, he says, God, if it wasn't for Milton, I wouldn't have found a higher power. And I'd heard somebody else say, this guy was said to me, Milton, I don't know, I can't find a higher power. And I heard somebody else say it. And I said, oh, you got to remember, it ain't you. And he thinks I saved his life. But I was talking the talk. And little by little, guys asked me to share with them. I didn't want to do like I was talking. But because they asked me, they forced me to walk like I was talking. They forced me to do these things. Because my ego couldn't stand anything else. It wasn't because I wanted to be wonderful. It's because I could not let them say, he ain't doing it. And that's why I did those things. I'm thrilled to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out who my enemy is. It's me. I found out who my problem is. It's me. And I have a mirror in my bathroom. And I have a little sign that says up there, when I brush my teeth, I see it every morning. It says, you are now looking at the problem. I am the problem. There isn't a problem outside of me. My relationship does not have to be with you any longer. My relationship doesn't have to be with my wife. I hear people talk, my relationship. I couldn't understand that. I don't know how to have one. I just never knew how to have one. But it made sense for me to begin to try to have one with me and God. And so today I try to have an ongoing relationship with me and God. And the strangest things happen. I seem to be able to have one with you. You see, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to be my own best friend. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to find the love that God gave me from the get-go. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that I don't have to bargain away my love any longer. It's mine. It's my gift from God. And it's the most rewarding thing. I'm freer today than I've ever been in my life. There's an old saying, church we used to sing, "Oh freedom, oh freedom. Oh, freedom over me, my Lord. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free." It's an old slave song. The old slaves knew about slavery, just like alcoholics know about slavery. We know all about it. Martin Luther King ended one of his many speeches like this. He said, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." Thank you.
Turn the tape over now, please.
Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization, which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening, everyone. My name is Dixie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Our primary purpose is to maintain our own sobriety and to carry our message to the alcoholics who still suffer. I have stated that I am an alcoholic. Are there any other alcoholics present? Not to embarrass you, but in order that we may get to know you at the coffee break and after the meeting, are there any newcomers in their first week of sobriety? And if so, would you please raise your hands? The heart of our program is laid out in a portion of Chapter 5 of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. To those who are new, these three pages may sound strange and unrelated to our specific problems. Do not be discouraged. Take what you can and file the rest for future reference. Tonight, Stephen C. has been asked to read this portion of Chapter 5.
My name is Stephen Courtney, and I'm an alcoholic. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Excuse me, number one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. And tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Rick DeVee.
Everybody left. My name is Rick Duvall, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Chuck for asking me to share tonight. I was praying to my higher power to tell me what to say, and apparently wants to give you all a rest because nothing's occurring. I got sober in this group almost 13 years ago, and I was a wreck when I got here. I drank alcohol primarily for the effect it produced in me. We moved out here from Wisconsin, where I was born, when I was 13, and California was just too fast-paced for me, and drinking at those high school parties seemed to seem to be so dull and stupid. I seemed to be able to let go a little bit and be funnier and be able to dance a little better and talk to girls a little more. So that's why I drank, and I just looked for every opportunity to drink after that. I didn't try to justify my drinking. I just needed the drinking to not feel so dumb and out of place. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I weighed 225 pounds. I used other things for effect. Like food and cigarettes, and I was down to one friend. I was into a lot of pornography because the friend was male, and I wanted girls in my life, but I didn't know how to talk to real human beings, so I lived in fantasy, and I was unteachable at that time. As a matter of fact, I detoxed so badly that I had a condition which is not a medical term. It's called flight of mind. You cannot complete a sentence. You start to say something and then your mind just goes blank. You can't remember where you're at. I couldn't even give a man in this room, I'm not sure if he's here tonight, I haven't seen him, but gave me rides to meetings and home. And I remember one of the first nights he asked me, "Where do you live, Rick?" And I couldn't tell him. I couldn't give him directions to my house. And I was aware this was happening. And I thought, I can't get a job like this. I can't do anything in life. Apparently, getting sober means I'm just going to have to be a vegetable somewhere. And that scared me. And they would take out my driver's license and read the address. And then the guys in the car, who other people he was giving rides home, would direct him to my place. And that's how I got home when I first got here. I just came back from working overseas for the company that I was with for 11 years. I got the job. I went back to this company about a year after I was sober, and basically it was a walking off the street, no skills, teach me, I'm willing to do anything when I arrived there. But I had had a year of sobriety by that time, and they taught me a very basic job and what they wanted me to do, and Alcoholics Anonymous taught me everything else and how to do that job. And I stayed at that company, as I said, for 11 years, and just kept applying things I learned here to my real life problems on the job, and worked my way up in that company, and finally that company felt confident enough to send a guy who couldn't give directions to people how to get home. They felt confident enough to send me to Japan to set up a computerized purchasing system for the worldwide organization. And then what happened in Japan is I was over there for 4.5 months, and I was supposed to be there for 6 months to a year. But the head office canceled the project and switched it, and I went over to the UK, where they decided to shift it to, and worked over there for 3.5 months on something totally different. You know, how do you get from that point where you walk in the door and you can't even, you know, put together a conscious thought and verbalize it to a point where a company's going to... I mean, I worked it out this year. They spent tens of thousands of dollars on me every month, because they paid for my housing and my food and all that kind of stuff. Not my food, but my housing and my water and power and phone bills back here in the States. How do you get to that point? And the only thing that's been different from what I was trying to do in my life before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I was trying to get ahead in the world before I got sober, but I never seemed to get anywhere. And I got here and I just watched the examples and did. I have a sponsor here. That's how you really get to those places. I mean, I couldn't have gone to those places by myself. I had a sponsor here in the United States who I called from Japan and I called from England. And I had friends here. Steve Z managed my finances and went and got my mail and sent me over the important stuff and did that stuff here. And Glenn R took care of my car. I mean, I didn't do this by myself. I did it along with my AA brothers that I'd grown up with and my sponsor. And with you people, I had letters from you people and I had tapes being sent to me. I was not, you know, I'm not grown up enough to do that by myself. I'm just not. I'd like to think I am. And I did pretty well over there. But what I did do over there is I just did what I learned here. I found Alcoholics Anonymous in Tokyo. There's 30 English-speaking meetings a week. And I didn't go to 30 a week, but I was the treasurer of the Shinano Machi Friday Night Big Book group. And basically because there was only six of us in the meeting and I had by far the longest sobriety and they needed to give the money to somebody and they figured, well, if he steals it, what the hell, you know? While I was over there, I mean, fascinating things happened. I didn't hear anything new in Alcoholics Anonymous in Japan. I heard the same phrases we use here. The disease, the greatest thing about this traveling, I mean, there were many things, but I know now alcoholism is the same in Japan. It's the same in England. It's the same here. It will kill us if we don't pay attention to it and do something about it. It affects these people. The interesting thing about Japan is the meetings, though they were small, they were really international, because people looking for English-speaking meetings, no matter what country they came from, would come to the meetings. So you'd have a guy from France and a guy from Germany and a guy from England and guys from Japan and guys from all over the place at a single meeting. So you'd get the full flavor of what alcoholism around the world was like, and it's always the same. It was the same story. So I don't have any illusions anymore, like, well, maybe I could go drink in France, you know? It doesn't work that way, and the cures, the solution is the same. It's the same 12 steps done the same way. I did hear one new phrase in England, and interestingly enough, and by the way, I got involved in England too. I ended up sponsoring a priest over there who asked me at one meeting when I was first over there. He says, I don't have a sponsor, and do you think that's important? And I said, what are you doing in your program right now? And he said, nothing. I said, yeah, I think it's important. I think you should get moving. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll be your interim sponsor till we get you fixed up with somebody here. And I believe in on-site sponsorship, sponsors that see you at meetings. And so we went to meetings and I would see him there and check on him and we worked through some problems. And then I got him moving on a sponsor search, and before I left, he had a sponsor. And he felt good about it. You know, he knew this was what he, by the time he had done it a little bit, he knew that that's what he should have been doing. But the new thing I heard in England, now I may have heard it here before, but it just didn't register before. But a guy was talking about AAA, and he said, and he happened to be an American who was visiting over there. So it really wasn't from an English person. It wasn't like they're inventing new things over there about sobriety. We're all just doing the same thing. But this guy said, you know, AAA is, the first A stands for admittance. We have to admit we're alcoholics. And I've been through that. And the point of like saying, God, you hate it, but Jesus Christ, I am an alcoholic. I mean, when I look back at all the stuff I did and the arrests and the St. John's Mental Hospital lockup ward for the angel dust flashback that I had out on the street. And how did I get in this situation where I just want a nice hippie girlfriend? That's what I wanted when I got out of the military, you know, a nice natural girl. And instead what I got is like 300 Playboys stacked up in my living room, and that's what you see, and what you don't see is the crap back in the back room that I don't let anybody see because I don't want people to know about that stuff. How do you get from that point? Anyway, I had to admit that yes, that is me. I am an alcoholic. And then acceptance is that, okay, I am an alcoholic. So I better do something about it. I better work this program. That seems to be what it is. And that's the 12 steps if you're new. That's what we do. That's what I did over there. That's how I stayed sober. That's how I stayed abstinent. That's how I worked my 12-step program over there. I worked those 12 steps. And then final A is approval. We're there when we finally agree with this. It fits into our lifestyle. It's part of us. Admittance, acceptance, and approval. And I'm glad I'm an alcoholic now because, I mean, I could have learned many of these same lessons probably as a normie, but it seems to me it takes just as long almost to do it that way, but you have to do it on your own. I know now from this traveling that I want to be involved with people and I want to learn from people and I want to share with people. And so I want to continue to be a member of AA and AAA, and I hope you do too. Thanks for listening.
And our second 10-minute speaker is Phyllis D.
Phyllis, I'm an alcoholic. I'm wearing these shoes you're supposed to be able to run in even though they're high heels. Some friends of mine have them too. Didn't know I'd be doing it today though. I am very thankful that I'm in this group, and before I forget, I want to thank Chuck for asking me to speak. I, like Rick, I'm kind of speechless here. I think what I'd like to do is try and spend 3 1/3 minutes on what it was like, 3 1/3 on what happened, 3 1/3 on what it's like today. Although I don't have a watch. I don't know, maybe somebody can time me. Anyway, I'm not a Los Angeles native. I was born in the Midwest. And the drinking is the same wherever. That's actually where I did most of my drinking. I kind of want to relay a little story because it's something that happened very recently and it kind of cleared up something in my mind. as we do our inventories, we sometimes go over things that happened when we were very young. And my father's an alcoholic and there were some negative things that happened. My father was kind of violent when he drank. He never hit me or anything, but he was really crazy. And those were painful experiences, so I've written inventories about this and remembered it. And, there's a temptation, I think, to think, well, you know, I've had these traumatic experiences, and the world of alcoholism treatment and psychiatrists are more than ready to tell you, yes, you know, this is to blame. And I don't really find that that's a useful thing for me to think about. You know, I can't dwell on why I'm not able to function. You know, I have to dwell on how to function, and that's what I've learned here. But anyway, back to this little thing that happened. They have this thing in psychology, and it's always back and forth. You know, were you born this way? Were you made this way? Whatever. And I always wondered about my sister, who I sort of introduced to drinking, because she's obviously, you know, we're the same family, and we have the same experiences, same, you know, bad things happen to us. And I kind of watched her drinking because she really functions like a normal person. She really just kind of, her emotions are sort of normal and her life is sort of normal. But I just wondered about it. And she came and visited me recently. And we're talking about drinking. And she said the thing that just, you know, she's not an alcoholic at all. I mean, she isn't. Anyway, she said, well, you know, drinking, 3 is my limit. Always has been, always will be. And if I'm ever in a situation where for social reasons, like her husband is a college professor and they've had occasions to travel around the world, so they went to Russia a few times, and in Russia it's kind of, you know, this thing with vodka. You know, at dinner here, have another one. And so she said, and in that situation I had like 5, and so I went to bed, my head spun, I got sick. I know that's gonna happen. If I have 5, I'm gonna get sick. And if that happens and I'm sick, I remember that for a long time, and I don't do that again. And I said, well, the difference between you and me is that that's what I did every Saturday night. And on Sunday, I felt it and I felt bad, but the next weekend I was there again and again and again and again and again. And I guess I forgot, or it was more like I just didn't care, you know. It was what I had to put up with. Drinking became for me the only thing that made me feel like life was worth living, like I was real, you know. I somehow didn't feel like very powerful when I wasn't drinking. There's something in me that I needed to kind of compete. You know, I looked around and I'd say, okay, who's the person around me that I admire the most, who seems to have the most personality, who's the leader of our group, you know, that kind of thing. And then I wanted to set myself up to be equal to that person, equal to the best. If I was the best, then I was okay. But one of the things I had to accept, you know, Rick was talking about acceptance. I've had to accept in sobriety in order to be comfortable what I am like, you know, who I am. And I'm not, you know, what I thought I was or what I wanted to be when drinking. And I've come to, you know, that just has to be all right. You know, I'm not the life of the party. So I tried to be when I drank, and I thought I was, and I think probably some of my crazy drinking friends thought I was at times. My goal in life at that point was to walk into a room. Of course, I'd already had a few drinks before I went there to the party. And if the door opened and I walked in and everyone said, "She's here, she's here," then I thought I was a success. And that's the kind of stuff that became what was important to me. I really was kind of, I had a good childhood in the sense of, you know, I was kind of protected. We had a pretty stable family except for my dad. He was gone after a while. And nothing ever really seemed like it was that out of control until after I left home. I didn't drink until after I left my house. I became very depressed when I left home. It was like I just didn't have the tools for living. My family kind of protected me. And slowly, you know, I was hospitalized before I drank because I was depressed. And so I soon found drinking as the answer to that. And I drank for about 10 years. And when I moved to California, it had become just not fun anymore. California was sort of like a nice place for me to get sober. It's more acceptable here to do self-help things. And that was kind of the path I was going on. I really wanted for several years before I got sober to actually improve my life, make it better. And it just wasn't happening. I was, you know, all these books on behavior modification, and you know, just endless books on Eastern religion. And came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was hard for me to get involved. And I didn't really stay sober until I came to this group. And when I came to this group, I had a degree of what I think is probably something that I'm very fortunate to have had, which is surrender. Surrender, I notice people that have been close to me that haven't stayed sober, it seems like there was some point where they couldn't surrender a certain thing in their life or things. And I'm really grateful that I have the degree that I've been able to have. And I have, for the most part, as they say in the book, the educational kind of spiritual experience. I've been told, and I read in the book, that that's what we have to have. We have to have a spiritual experience in order to stay sober. I have needed all the help that I've gotten here. I'm really nervous. I feel like I have not been a rocket to stardom here, but there's been so much improvement. You know, my life today, I've kind of looked in the past at how long I lived places, who was in my life, and when I came to AA in Pacific Group, it just sort of like, it was like, live here, live there, live here, live there, this relationship, that relationship, that, 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 that. And then it just kind of went, I lived in places longer, had the same people in my life. And when I visit with my family and with people, the way that I live doesn't make me ashamed. And I think that's worth a lot. And I was not able to maintain relationships before. I've been taught here how to have dignity and how to be a friend and how to be in a relationship. I was able to get married here, and I have a little daughter now, and I work, and I kind of thought when sobriety was working that things would be kind of like easy, you know, just kind of march along. And in one sense, it's easy that when a problem comes up, I have a way to deal with it. That's the good thing. You know, we have a way to go. But I feel like I've never worked harder in my entire life. And I'm just grateful that I have the strength now that comes from the help that I get here for being able to do that. 1 minute left. So I want to just say that I continue to value this group very much, and I'm in finance class with some other people, and it's really good for me. I'm not the greatest in that area. I like the fact that here we can share with each other, and I can let people know what's going on with me so that they can really help me, and I can hopefully be an example to other people of how things work. And I'm going to stop now. Thanks a lot.
Please remain seated for this announcement.
And we celebrate them here, and you get a candle for every 365 days of continuous sobriety. And we have several birthdays tonight. We define sobriety as free of alcohol, pills, or pot, or anything that affects you from the neck up. Our first birthday tonight is for 1 year for Ellen B.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ellen, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'd like to thank Susan K., my sponsor, for my cake and for her love and support all year. She's been incredible, and I don't think without her guidance I'd be here tonight. And I want to thank Clancy for the structure of this group, which I love, and all of you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Ellen. Now for 5 years, Kenzo C.
Hi, I'm Kenzo, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Jim, for that cake, for his sponsorship, for his friendship, and all the time he spends with me. I'd like to thank Clancy for his fine example and what he's given all to us. And I'd like to thank all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Kenzo. Now for 6 years, Keith J.
I'm Keith, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'd like to thank Clint for the cake, his sponsorship, and his example. I'd like to thank Clancy for his example in the Pacific Group. I'd like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous and all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Keith. And for 7 years, Peter C.
My name's Peter Clarkson. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Rob, thank you for that cake. Thank you for 7 years of sponsorship and all your support and all the difficult times I've had recently. Clancy, thank you for your example, your consistency, and for being such a trendsetter. Kimberly, thank you for your love and your support. And thank you for making me laugh. There are three people that come to mind when I think of practicing these principles in all our affairs: Tom B., Z. Mansour, and Rick DeVee. Thank you. Thank you, class of 83, and thanks to all of you.
Happy birthday, Peter. Now for 10 years, Donna D.
My name is Donna Downer, and I'm an alcoholic. It seems like I've been waiting forever to get that second digit. I'd like to thank the Pacific Group for my first 6 years of sobriety, Michelle A. for my first year, Sharon B. for my second year of sobriety, and Diane Palmer for the last 8 years. I love her a lot, and she's really taught me a lot. I'd like to thank Clancy, who through his gentleness and sometimes through his pointed comments has helped me to grow a lot. I'd also like to thank my husband, Rick. Through his love and support, he has demonstrated to me that I don't have to keep my mouth shut in order to help a marriage work. And I'd also like to thank God for getting me here and keeping me here when I didn't want to be here so I could see Ted. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Don and I, for 14 years, Rob K.
Hello, everybody. My name is Rob Kozacek. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a very lucky man tonight. I have a blessing of sobriety and the love of my family. I have many friends who I have consistently reminded of how beautiful they are and how much they bring into my life. I have had three men specifically who have been extremely important, make it possible for me to be alive today and be here. Clancy I, who welcomed me into his yard 14 years ago and has consistently shown me a terrific example and a way to function in Alcoholics Anonymous and in this world. And I appreciate his love and his interest. My friend Clint, for consistently helping me and being my friend, and for his bravery in showing me a lot of wonderful ways to go out there and function in this world. And my sponsor, Chuck, who I love very much, who's been a great example to me and a friend and a real hero to me. I'm real grateful to have him in my life. Thank you very much. And thanks for letting me take a cake tonight.
Happy birthday, Rob. And now for 15 years, Ben R. My name is Ben, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Millie for giving me that cake and for being my sponsor and a very special friend, and I value her friendship very much. I'd also like to thank Clancy for being a special friend and for his love and my love for him. He's a great example to me. I would also like to thank all my friends that came from faraway places to celebrate this day with me. This is a special day. I have 15 years that was a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I celebrated my 90th birthday. Hey. And it was a gift from the Alcoholics Anonymous. Also, I'd like to thank the class of 75 for accepting me, and the Pacific Group for accepting me too. Thank you very much, and I love you all.
I'm Milton Merle, a grateful alcoholic. I never thought in my lifetime I'd ever have the opportunity to take a cake at the Pacific Group. It's the first time. Thank you.
We also want to thank Diana Van El from Fargo, North Dakota, who sent in $17 for her 17 years of sobriety. We appreciate that, Diana. And that's all the birthdays.